And good evening. It is Intuitive Soul Radio with your host, Lori Houston. And tonight is going to be, well, it's going to be a special night because we have author Philip Shepherd here. And Philip and I have been just chatting away for the last hour or so. And, you know, Philip has an incredibly unique book because it's a very different perspective on some topics that we all talk about, but I really like it, Philip, because you've brought in something that not a lot of people bring in. But the book is entitled New Self, New World: Recovering Our Senses in the 21st Century. So welcome, Philip.
Lori, it's such a pleasure to be here.
Okay, so, you know, usually what it's really a pleasure because you're actually here in the studio, which is always the best way to have an interview. But I want you to tell us a little bit about your journey, because that's usually, people kind of relate things by hearing how they, you know, sort of connect with your journey and certainly the journey of the book, because that was quite a journey. So why don't we begin there?
Yeah, they're pretty intertwined, those two journeys. And in terms of the book, you know, my journey goes back to, I was a teenager, and I looked around as a kid. I looked around at the world of the adults, and it just did not add up. They had an idea of what mattered and what you should do and what was important and how it should be done, and it all seemed out of sync to me, and I felt confined and bound up in a, I don't know, it was almost like this, almost like a cell, like a prison cell of these unseen ideas that I kept running into and couldn't do anything about because I couldn't see them. And I knew at the heart of it that my culture was actually communicating a story about what it meant to be human, and it communicates that story in its architecture, in the language, in the metaphors it uses, in the way it designs and builds homes, in the automobiles it builds, all of these artifacts that we build are in fact reflections of the self. And I was spoon-fed, of course, that story as a kid, and could not see it, and it becomes your normal. And so I chafed and raged, and and finally, you know, at the age of 18, I graduated high school and stood at this fork in the road. One fork led to Trinity College, studying physics, and, you know, then you get a job, and the home, and the, you know, it was all laid out. It was like the tracks were laid down. Excuse me. And the other fork in the road led into the darkness, and it tugged at me. And this thought of going to Japan to study no theater was such a ridiculous notion that I couldn't I couldn't ignore it. And I didn't have any money, of course, as a kid, and so I went to England, worked in the theater a bit, bought a bicycle, and headed off for Japan on this bicycle. And one of the prime motivators in doing that was to shed what I'd taken for granted, to shed what my normal was. And on a bicycle, you're so permeable, you're so exposed to the world around you. I passed through so many different ways of understanding what it means to be human that at the end of it, you know, I so clearly remember coming back to my home in Toronto at the time, looking around at the culture and saying, whoa, this is wild. This is just crazy. You know, things that you just wouldn't notice. Having been away for 2 years and been away in so many different cultures, it was amazing to come back. And so all these questions arose. And one of the gems from my journey was in studying no theater. I was in theater in Canada and loved it and still do. And to come to terms with what those actors were doing on stage, it baffled me. It moved me. It stirred my passions. They brought me understandings and experiences, and I had no idea how they were doing this. And I had to come to terms with the Japanese concept of hara, which is their word for belly. And in the Japanese culture, your profoundest truths, your deepest sentiments about yourself and the world around you are found in the belly. So there's this whole host of expressions in which we use the head and they use the belly. So we may say he's hot-headed. They say his belly rises easily. We may say he's got a good head on his shoulders. He has a developed belly. And the issue isn't one of semantics. It's a different bodily experience. And it took me a long time to come to terms with what that meant for myself, how it changed my experience and my openness to the world around me. And out of that, really, the book arose.
Hmm. Wow. It's interesting. And, your book, let's talk about the premise of your book. And there's kind of a few, but, that we've been stuck in the masculine energy of doing. And for a long time, and we need to move towards the feminine energy of being. You're looking at me, and I think that is kind of, it's very profound, because it's not that we haven't heard it before, but the way you bring it about, the way you describe it, the way you show us what it means, the doing aspect, this doing that we're always in our heads, we're always stuck in the past, the future. It's always, what are we doing and how are we doing it and what can we do to fix it and what can we do to change it, and what it's always about doing. And so we're always trying to analyze, we're always trying to figure everything out. And really it's about, we need both, obviously. We're just way too over, probably 99% are we doing versus being. It's phenomenal. But the feminine energy of the being, and which of course we all need to have in a balanced way. It's not really about whether you're a man and you need to be masculine, or whether you're a woman and you need to be feminine. We need to balance this out. But talk about this. It's a fascinating concept, because I think, even though we've all heard it before, the way you talk about it is unique.
It's one of the biggest questions for me was, how did it happen? How did we end up living in our heads? And even to ask that question is to realize living in the head is not normal. And what's interesting is you go back to the Neolithic Revolution. You go back 10,000 years, and two things happened at the same time. One is the goddess started to lose her hold, and eventually the god triumphed. So the oracle at Delphi was one of the last strongholds of the goddess, and then it became Apollo's territory. Maria Gimbutas, whom I talk about in the book, this phenomenal archaeologist, really brought all the pieces together for us in a way that enabled us to understand what this goddess-centered culture was. So there's that transition from goddess to god, which is a transition from mother to father. It's a transition from female to male. At the same time, and And this is something that I talk about in my book at length, and I don't know of anyone else who's looked at it. But at the same time, the center of our thinking in the body started to migrate. So in the Neolithic, the center of our thinking was associated with the navel. And the Indo-European root for our word navel is their word navel. But what's interesting is that it shows up in Sanskrit, the same root, to mean relationship. Mm-hmm. It shows up in a host of ancient European languages to mean the hub of a wheel. And in fact, there is an English word, nave, that means the hub of a wheel. And you think, the hub of a wheel. Now, the Indo-European culture was so embodied that they developed metaphors not out of cleverness, but the action. It's how they felt it in their bodies. So you think of a hub as this empty stillness around which everything revolves. And that is what they associated with the navel. And then you move forward through the Neolithic into Egyptian or ancient Greek. In Homer, for example, there's a word phreen that is translated into English as diaphragm, but also as mind. To them, it was one and the same. They could feel their thinking in the diaphragm. The Egyptians, when they prepared a body for mummification, they put the brain in the garbage, literally. They took the internal organs and preserved them in jars, but the heart they left in the body because the heart was understood to be the organ of thought. And you'd need it in the afterlife. And then you see it in there's a book by Plato, Timaeus. And in Timaeus, he describes how the gods made us, and they made this divine sphere patterned on the divine spheres of the heavens, the head. And then they realized that the head was going to get stuck if it didn't have a vehicle. So they gave it limbs and arms so it could move about. And that's, you know, that's in Plato. So we are in the head by 350 BC. And since that time, we've become increasingly devoted to male values. So the shift from goddess to god was paralleled and facilitated by a shift from the thinking center in our belly up to the head. And today, you know, the head, the brain is where we think, so we think. and you think, well, where else would I live but in the head? In fact, you know, neurobiology has shown us that every cell in the body participates in thinking. And more than that, there is a center in the belly that is an independent brain. By any criterion you wish to assess whether it's a brain or not a brain, it's called the second brain, it's called the enteric nervous system, but it is an independent, thinking, remembering, acting, processing brain in the belly. And it's paralleled in Mayan culture, because in Mayan culture, in their mythology and in their understanding of what a human is, a human has two skulls. There's the skull that contains the brain in the head, and the pelvic bowl is the second skull. And there was balance between these two skulls, and they're connected in their mythology, by a serpent. So it's like a two-headed serpent. But these two poles of the self are in balance, and in our culture, we've become unipolar thinkers. We think in the head, and that inflects every mote of our existence with the taint of male values that have dissociated from female values.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a really, it's a book that will give you, if you're a seeker and you're wanting to understand this to the depth, I mean, this is a book that will really assist you in understanding your principles, because you go into, you know, a lot of history and a lot of, it's fascinating, the journey that you take us on to get us to understand how these principles came into effect and how they're so dominant in our society. I mean, So you really need to read the book. And as many times as we can have you on here, which we will try and get you on a few more times, because there's no way we're going to be able to even, you know, approach even a tiny piece of this book tonight, but because it's just so huge. So you talk about that we've been separated from our bodies and we live in our heads, and we're unable to join the world, to be in the world, because we think about it, we analyze it, and we're judging it. And that's really, you know, that's really how we're living our lives right now. It's
moment by moment. Yeah.
And the judgment and the analyzing, and like we're thinking about everything. We're not being. We're not in our body. We're not in our hearts. We're in our heads thinking about being in our hearts, thinking about being in our body, thinking about everything that's going on, the analyzing, the judging. I mean, Will you talk about it? I mean,
In New Self, New World, I say that the fundamental wound in our culture is our separation of thinking from being. And there's an ancient Greek philosopher, Parmenides, who posited that the senses will deceive you, only reason is going to lead you to the truth. Whereupon he reasoned almost impeccably that nothing can move. So yeah, the senses can deceive you, but reason can take you like on a joyride that never comes back. This schism between our thinking and our being is something that we have clasped onto ever since. And we, you know, it shows up in our understanding of what intelligence is. We think of intelligence as the faculty that can reason abstractly. When we deliver an IQ test, that's what we're measuring, the faculty of abstract reasoning. And definitely that's a part of our intelligence, but it's a very, very narrow part. In New Self, New World, I basically say intelligence is no other than sensitivity. There are so many kinds of sensitivity, and there's a sensitivity to arithmetic relationship. There's a sensitivity to trigonometric function, just as there's a sensitivity to a child's moods, or to rhythm, or melody, or the patterns of cloud in the sky. There are numberless sensitivities, and by living in our heads, we dissociate from the body. Basically, when you live in your head, you're withdrawing from the sensations of the body and committing yourselves to duplicates of the world. We construe ideas about the world. We take the world's flux, the world's energy, and we trap it in our ideas. And ideas are frozen energy. Energy that doesn't move. It's fixed. And these ideas eventually become systems. You know, the male strength is to systematize. And we build these systems that represent the world, represent the self, represent how we should relate to the world, and we develop an idea of the self that basically tells us who we should be. We have a sense of who we, and we're encouraged to know who we are. So there's a choice that you actually have in between. You can be who you know yourself to be, or you can be present, but you can't do both. And so we defer to the abstraction, we defer to this system of ideas that represents the world, and we think there's redemption in information. We think if we have a problem, the way to solve it is by getting more information, more information, more information. And there's an alternate path, which is to drop in our own wholeness. So the ideas shatter the world into bits, and we think that if we can know those bits, we'll gain the leverage that will give us the control to solve the problems. And that's a part of problem solving. But my gosh, in our day-to-day life, there's nothing that can't be enriched and advanced by dropping into your own wholeness. And that's not an idea, that's an experience. That means dropping into your body, dropping into the present that sustains your every breath.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about the known self, since you did bring it up? I mean, that's a whole area of discussion that could go on for hours. But it's, you know, that's, you know, we keep wanting to know who we are, yet we are so determined that we already know who we are because that's how we've related to the world.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, I mentioned the Oracle of Delphi, and there's that carved into the stone, that injunction, know thyself. But Richard Tarnas made it clear that the way the Greeks understood know thyself was know yourself through the logos, know yourself through the world around you. So anything in the entire cosmos exists only through relationship. You know, quantum physics goes down to an electron and understands that the electron per se has no existence except through relationship with all else that is. Now, what we've done with the self is we've imagined it to be something that exists independent of the world. We think that our thoughts are something that we create, that our strength is something that belongs to us. And in fact, your truest strength is the strength you stand in, not the strength that you hold within. Your deepest thinking isn't a product of axons exchanging information in your cranium. Your deepest thinking is something that happens hand in hand with the world around you. The present, quantum physics, again, has shown us that information can't be destroyed. Everything that has ever existed is still coursing through the present moment, just as everything that is to come is blossoming in its potentiality in the present moment. So the present is fathomless, it's bottomless. There's no limit to how it can inform you, but the medium through which it informs you is the body. There are two, I talk about this in New Self, New World, that there are two ways of knowing, and we've devoted ourselves to digital knowing. We've devoted ourselves to that kind of information that's broken into packets, and we try to accumulate them to gain control and get ahead and solve our problems. The other kind of knowing, which I refer to as analog knowing, is the currents that ride the present. And there are two, do I have time for two little stories?
Absolutely.
So a very, very dear friend of mine, when he was a kid, he was in class one day in his school, and he was compelled in the middle, the teacher was still talking at the blackboard, and he stood up. And he ran out of the classroom, and he ran home to come through the kitchen door to find his mother in a pool of blood on the floor. And she looked up at him, and she said, "Thank God you came, Jack. I prayed you would." There are ways of knowing that so far transcend the specificity of time and place and knowing in a concrete fashion. So the other story has to do with Polynesian sailors. they can navigate 500 miles or across the Pacific Ocean and find a single island. And the navigators, there's a great book by Wade Davis called The Wayfinders, and he goes into this, and he says, you know, they choose a navigator as an infant, and they'll take this infant and put it in a tidal pool. And the infant just feels the currents of the water and comes to know them. So that later, as an adult, a navigator, or wayfinder, as Wade Davis called it, can sit in a boat on the ocean. There's a chop to the sea, and below that chop are these rhythmic swells. And the navigator can feel through the canoe five distinct swells passing through. And these are refraction patterns from distant islands. And they guide the navigator on his journey of 500 miles. So in the same way that the navigator can sit in a canoe and feel what is through the currents of the sea, we can sit at rest in our bodies in the moment and feel the currents of what is. And that's really what being is about. I mean, being is our relationship with everything. And the more open you are to all your relationships with the world around you, the more distinctly you can feel the self. So it's not a self that is removed from the world. It's not the self that we know. It's the self that the world reveals to you. And that's, I distinguish between the known self, which is this duplicate, this construct we create, and the felt self. And the felt self, it occurred to me writing the book, you know, that to feel the self as a whole is something in our culture that almost never happens. Mm. We can think we know the self as a whole. We can feel aspects of the self. You know, we can feel the emotions. We can feel the toes. We can feel the memories. We can feel all these parts of the self. But to allow the self just to come into its own ease and wholeness and just sit at the center of that and feel it is a very different experience, but it's the experience that connects us with the whole world and also connects us with our own passions and our own path.
Right. You know, while you're talking about, you know, the feeling experience and, you know, being able to sit in the water and be able to know, you know, what's going around you, how many hundreds of feet, or hundreds of miles. You know, it brings us back to this known self where we, you know, we have labeled everything, and it's from our labeling of everything that we stop experiencing it. Because once we've labeled it, we no longer need to experience it. And I guess, you know, Eckhart Tolle, when he was, you know, doing New Earth, I mean, that was the whole thing about, you know, you need to see everything with new eyes. You need to, it's a really difficult and challenging thing to do. You can go out and you can sit and you can root yourself in the ground and you can feel everything around you and you can experience it that way. It's probably easier to do it with your eyes closed than it is to actually do it with them open, because when they're open, you have the labels of what everything is. So it's an interesting experience to try and do that. I mean, you have exercises in the book that are, you know, are trying to get you to begin to understand the whole rhythm of our bodies and how, you know, how to get into it more. But where do you, like, for people that do want to have this experience, what would you recommend for people?
The big hurdle is our sense of isolation.
Mm.
So we sit within this self-made isolation chamber, basically. And I talk about an isolation chamber in my book, and all these experiments that they've done, they put people into isolation chambers, and eventually, and it doesn't usually take very long, they go mad, they start hallucinating. So as we withdraw from the body, we're doing that to ourselves. And we were isolated from the world because the body is our only bridge to the world. And we begin to fantasize about it. And we live the fantasies and are guided by the fantasies, and we lose the pulse of the present. And our culture, it's been a long, long time. When we first imagined, in the ancient Greeks did this, I think it was Melissus, what matter was made of. Melissus thought of the atom. This bit of matter that could not be reduced, that joined with other irreducible bits of matter to make this teacup or whatever. And atom and individual mean the same thing. Mm. So Melissus came up with the idea of an atom because that's how we were already experiencing the self. I mean, we see the world in terms that we're experiencing the self. So it's a long, long, old story that has pulled us into the head, out of the body, and into our isolation. So if we're going to get beyond the labels and melt ourselves into connection with the world around, it begins with the body. It begins with the breath. It begins with a sense of rest, to be at rest in the body, in the moment. And when you can come to rest in the body, in the moment, that's when you begin to discover kinship, and you begin to discover companionship. And, you know, again, quantum mechanics is phenomenal, and physics is phenomenal, and underlying all of this sense of companionship is the phenomenal sensitivity of what is to who you are. There's a book called Chance and Chaos by Paul Riddell, anyway. He talks about this thought experiment, and he said, imagine at the farthest, remotest fringe of the universe, an electron, and say you could suddenly eliminate the gravitational field of that single electron. If you were on Earth watching molecules in the air in a room, you'd watch a molecule go through about 50 collisions that it would have gone through even if the gravitational field were intact. But after about 50 collisions, that molecule you're tracking would miss a molecule that it would otherwise have hit. And from that moment on, all the interactions in the room become different from what they would have been. If you go outside the next day and there's some turbulence in the weather, you'll feel gusts of wind that wouldn't have been there. You'll see cloud patterns that are different because the gravitational field, which is a weak force, the gravitational field of a single electron at the remotest fringe of the universe had been eliminated. So you realize when you lift your arm, all the universe answers and feels it. When your heart beats, all the universe feels it. And there's you know, we, in the same way that we've deprived consciousness, deprived our bodies of consciousness, we've deprived the world around us of consciousness. And there are so many concrete, anomalous examples that show us that all the world participates in consciousness. It responds to consciousness and not incoherently, but coherently. For example, there's a project called the Global Consciousness Project, and they even have a website. They have random event generators all over the world, and these are things that just, it's like they spit out ones and zeros in no particular order, just randomly, and they're designed to be random, and they're all correlated into a computer that kind of charts their average, you know, averages them all and charts them together, and this thing, you know, goes along as a steady line, but the experimenters noticed this phenomenal spike in the chart, and it just happened to coincide with Princess Diana's funeral. And then they realized there were spikes every New Year's. And then when 9/11 happened, there was a huge spike. So at a quantum level, at an atomic, subatomic level, the consciousness of the world, the consciousness of our shared humanity, is changing events. It's affecting events, and it's not doing it randomly. It's not just that they're being bombarded with energy and changing. No, they're changing coherently, in the same way that intention can manifest coherently. You know, Larry Dossey is just such a brilliant MD. Has done so much work with prayer and has demonstrated, you know, irrefutably, prayer has an effect. And he feels, as a physician, it's irresponsible of him not to make use of that, not to begin each day by praying for his patients. There are famous experiments that demonstrate that if you observe a photon, a little packet of light, it will behave as a particle. If you don't observe it, it will behave as a wave. And it's just that issue. Can you know its path? Or can you not know its path? And in the index in my book, I have fun with that because the experiments have developed over the years trying to fool it, and the last experiment that I talk about actually goes back in time. So the photon would already have you know, gone through the slit and made its decision, is it a photon or not? And then the observers can choose whether or not to observe it, and still, even going backwards in time, you can't fool it. It's remarkable. So the labels are a sort of convenience. They're a shorthand that deliberately bypasses sensation, but it's sensation that attunes us to that fifth dimension of consciousness. It's sensation that lets me feel the teacup in its history and its presence and its companionship. And that analog form of knowing absolutely requires that we learn what it is to be at rest in the body. And when you're at rest in the body, I mean you're at rest on the pelvic floor in that second center of our consciousness. The difference between the cranium consciousness and the belly consciousness is that our heads, our craniums, that's the place where we can consciously think. The pelvic intelligence is where we can consciously be. And we have so dedicated ourselves to consciously thinking that we've cut that process off from our being, and it's simply uninformed by reality as a consequence. And so it runs round and round and round in its little tightly closed loop, unable ever to come to rest.
Wow. You talk about the mind and the pelvis, and what about the heart? What role does that play?
It's I talk about the brain and the head as the male aspect of our consciousness, and the pelvic intelligence as a female aspect of our consciousness. And what's interesting to me is the heart. The heart sits at what would create a golden section. You know, that principle, the Fibonacci, the relationship that shows up over and over again in the forms of nature and in architecture and in all we do, this 1.618 relationship. Well, that relationship is specifically what brings the part into relationship with the whole. So when you put a point on the line that divides it in that relationship, the proportion of the smaller part of the line to the larger part of the line is exactly the same as the larger part of the line to the whole line. So it's where the parts come into harmony with the whole. And that's where the heart sits in our body. So it's the place of reconciliation, in a sense, the place of harmony between those two poles of our thinking. But it's also, the heart is our gateway to the world around us. So that we can choose to close our hearts, we can choose to open our hearts, and if we're not aware of our hearts, probably they're closed, because that's just the way we've been taught to live. When you live in your head, your heart struggles to be open. But in a sense, that, you know, the book is called New Self, New World, because in moving beyond the labels, in moving beyond the separation that we've enforced on the self from the body, and the separation of the self from the world around us, in moving past that, the first task is to find that unity between the male aspect of our consciousness and the female aspect of our consciousness. There's such potential for exchange between them. There are exercises in the book that talk about what it means to take an idea, a sterile idea, such as the rose is red. And if you take that idea and formulate it in the head and let it drop down through the body to come to rest on the pelvic floor, that sterile idea becomes sensation. So the female, the pelvic intelligence, is what integrates. If the strength of the male aspect of our intelligence is to actually step away from something and gain perspective on it and understand its parts and systematize, the female aspect of our consciousness integrates. And we have become addicted to gathering information, and we have lost the ability to integrate it. So our lives are in pieces. Our bodies are not in harmony. We don't know any longer what it is, as I said, to feel the self as a whole. That requires integration, and integration can only happen through that genius of being that rests in the pelvic bowl.
Yeah. We quest for the wholeness. So that oneness that you're talking about, that understanding or feeling or sensing versus understanding, it's really our soul speaking, and it's about freedom and creativity and presence, and it's opening up to that consciousness that is the oneness, that is everything. And it's through our bodies that we can awaken this full intelligence and come home. How, I mean, the quest has been going on forever. It certainly seems to have intensified in the last, I don't know, maybe 20 years, but even more so in the last few. It's like we know that we're missing something. We are all seeking something. we're trying to grasp and understand this incredible journey that we're on and the incredible experience that we can have. And your book certainly allows us to see a different aspect that we may have been missing. What do we do? How do we... Yeah, what do we do? See?
Yeah, no, you know, it's true,
it's,
yeah.
It's like that's what we think. What do we do?
We have been living for 10,000 years with this paradigm that has pulled us towards male values. It's pulled us into the head. And we are trying to solve that independent of the body. And so even when we turn to the body, you know, it's considered a paragon of virtue to really listen to the body. But when you examine that phrase, it's setting up a model by which you're standing independent of the body and deciding to pay attention to it, kind of cocking an ear, in the way that a robin might listen to a worm under the ground. But so even though it's moving us, putatively moving us towards a reconciliation with the body, it's entrenching us more deeply in this paradigm of living in the head. It's not a matter of listening to the body. It's a matter of dropping down into that seething, dark, chaotic intelligence and living there until you understand its harmonies. And it's, you know, the myths talk about that, because when Orpheus made his journey to the underworld, you've got this male... a hero trying to reconcile with the female element, and he has to go through the terrors of the Shades and Cerberus, and finally the horror of standing before Pluto. And he achieves it through love. When Pluto asks him, how of all the mortals is it possible that only you have made it here? He answers, love, not I, but love alone. And the love he speaks of is a love of harmony, is a love of his truth, is a love for the lost female side of his life. And that love, you know, We think of love as an emotion, in the way that we think of anger or pity or other things as emotion. And love is our supreme intelligence. There's this great, well-known American botanist, George Washington Carver, who was born as a slave and taught himself, and he could look at a plant and know what it needs, and he became famous. He could heal animals. He could heal plants, and people. He didn't even study at university. How do you know these things? And he said, you know, if you love something enough, it will talk to you. And that's what this love is. So that to reverse our 10,000-year-old commitment to the male element, the most important thing is to understand first that it can't be done without the body. And you look, you know, it breaks my heart, because we as a species, we were like a cancer on the world, and we can't stop, and we keep trying to solve it, but we are so deeply divided within ourselves that all we can do is foist our divisions on the world and more deeply entrench them, and every solution we come up with seems to create five more problems. And it's like the Hydra, you cut off a head and more grow, and the world will teach us how to heal what we've done. But it can teach us nothing when we are deaf to our own bodies. And I think that's the nub of it.
Yeah. Yet how do we make that connection? I mean, we can intellectualize it, we can understand it, but that's not where we make that connection.
No. Joseph Campbell talked about the hero and the tyrant in very specific terms, and people forget this because he spells it out at the beginning of Hero with a Thousand Faces. And he says the hero is the man of self-achieved surrender. The hero, the tyrant, is the man of self-achieved independence. Self-achieved independence is the very prize that each of us is taught to seek in our lives, in one way or another. Financial independence, emotional independence. We're taught to create a self that can stand in its own strength. And there is no such thing. It's a fantasy. What the tyrant pursues is a fantasy. The hero, the man of self-achieved surrender, it requires a surrender. It requires a surrender of all the tools we've built up to solve our problems. It requires a surrender of the arrogance that lets us think that we're independent of the world, the arrogance that invites us to judge everyone we meet, and it's a surrender that takes us to gentleness. And gentleness, gentleness is what liberates us from having to judge everything and control everything. And gentleness, again, gentleness isn't a quality that's contained within us. Gentleness is a quality of interrelationship. And it's all it gentleness is a highly sensitized form of interrelationship. When a mother moves a baby's arm into the sleeve of a sweater, she does so gently. She is picking up so many cues from that arm. That's what gentleness enables. Gentleness enables a conversation, and we're so busy, we're so busy giving and putting out and presenting. We have impoverished our capacity to just receive. Mm-hmm. And that's what the mother does in the interaction with the child. She's helping the child, but she's receiving exactly where that child is. And the place of receptivity in our lives, again, is that place of rest in the body, is the pelvic floor, is that place of intelligence that is not withdrawn from the world, but opens to the world and attunes to all its subtle currents.
Yes. It makes me think of, how you said that, some people think that this is a self-help book. Yeah. And
alas.
and it's not a self-help book because it's helping us. And it's not even, again, it's not about understanding, because that takes it into a mental concept where it's in our head. It's really about, I guess it's about the surrendering. It's about that letting go. It's about just absorbing and being and finding that way within ourselves, and certainly relationships. There is no other way that we can be in this world.
Even exist. Yeah. There's a great philosopher, Heraclitus, my favorite Greek philosopher. He's the guy who said you can't step into the same river twice because it'll have moved on. Another thing he said is The God's presence in the world goes unnoticed by those who do not believe in gods. And I would rephrase that to remind us that the guidance of the world does not exist for those who do not believe in the world's guidance. The world, you know, our actions can be informed or they can be uninformed. And it's interesting, you look at the dictionary, uninformed, one of the meanings of uninformed is dead. but to open to the present is to open to this bottomless guidance that fills you in everything you do and will inform, not even inform your decisions, inform your course, because it almost makes that whole responsibility for making the right decisions, it almost unburdens us of that, and you just know your path. And you can know your path in the most mundane of our day-to-day activities, or you can know your path that is catapulting you through the next 9 years to write this book, which is kind of what happened to me. But it's always there. It's always waiting for us, if only we can surrender and receive and attune ourselves in a very gentle way to the world speaking to us.
Mm-hmm. Well, clearly, we are going to have you come back because we barely touched the book, although I hope, you know, we've gotten out a nice bit of information to intrigue people enough to get your book. And we'll go through more because there's so much more to experience. Because you did put, obviously and clearly, 9 years of your life into this book, and well, even more, I think. That was just what it took to write it.
Yeah, the actual writing. Yeah, there was a prep period before that. There was some decades long. It's true. It's true.
And certainly, this is your unique voice that you are bringing to the world that you know I feel needs to be heard. So I would be honored to have you back, and we will continue this journey at another time. But, you know, there's so much in this book. Is there anything that, you know, you got a couple minutes, is there anything that you would like to say to people?
Well, one thing I'd say is if they go to my website, they can read the introduction, and that'll give them a sense of the book. The website is philipshepherd.com. Now, Philip and Shepherd can both be spelled different ways. So,
yes, they can.
Philip is with one L, Philip, and Shepherd is the way it appears in the dictionary, the guy who looks after sheep, Shepherd. So, philipshepherd.com. There's also a foreword by Andrew Harvey that you can have a look at and read, and that'll give you a sense of it. And it's available, you know, all over the place, Amazon, Chapters Indigo, hopefully your local bookstore, and maybe even your library.
And if not, then, you know, ask them to bring it in, because they can do that.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Well, it has been a great pleasure, as I knew it would be, because we've connected in the past. But, you know, it's you are just this gentle soul that has a great voice that needs to be heard. So,
well, thank you for giving it a chance, because it's a treat being here.
Yeah. Well, thank you. All right. So, again, it's philipshepherd.com, and the book is called New Self, New World, Recovering Our Senses in the 21st Century. And certainly it is about getting into our senses and being instead of the known head that we tend to live in all the time. Yes. All right. So hopefully you will join us again. We will definitely have you back, and have a great evening, and we will be back next week.